The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 89 from the Hikigan Roku. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion expect to do with so many hands and eyes?" Dao Wu said, "It's like a person in the middle of the night whose hand reaches out for the pillow." Yunyan said, "Ah, I understand." Dao Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yunyan said, "Everywhere on the body is hands and eyes." Dao Wu said, "You've said quite a bit, but you've only said 8/10. Yunyan said, "Elder brother, how do you understand it?" Dao Wu said, "All over the body is hands and eyes." Hands and eyes all over the body. Hands and eyes and ears, sensation comes. In the eye, we call it seeing. In the ear, we call it hearing. The tongue, we call it tasting. A moment after moment is the arising. This arising that we call life. And of course, in the mind, we call it thinking. And it is this arising that we are looking into. And in Zen, we aren't so much interested in the particular content, right? Moment after moment, that changes the content of your thoughts, of your opinions. The content of your heart, the many mind states that we travel through, or we might say that travel through us here on retreat. Certainly, these retreats are a kind of pilgrimage, and not the kind of pilgrimage where you exactly know where you're going. But in coming on this sesshin, or even in sitting down to do zazen for a moment, we are setting out from the safe shore of what we know. We are setting out, leaving home. Of course, leaving home to find our true home. And this wonderful story of Zen, story of Buddhism, which has been handed down and elaborated and comes to us with such richness. For me, I find when I look into any one part, it leads me to the whole, so much. In this tradition, so many jewels, so many entry points. And of course, all these entry points are only here in this moment. It is happening, your life is happening, you are happening, the universe is happening right here. But how do we get to it? We hear these words and we might agree and say, yes, right here. But yet for so many of us, some sense of separation, maybe just a tiny bit, maybe none at all, but maybe a huge sense of feeling separate, feeling we long deeply. For connection, we long deeply to get to the heart of it. We long deeply for something. This longing is what brings us to practice. And for each of us, of course, it's different. And we call this bodhicitta, the way-seeking heart-mind. And for me, almost as long as I can remember in my life, has been some sense of separation, some sense of aloneness, and wanting to connect to others, to myself, to life. And Zen for me is part of this lifelong journey to connect. And of course, along the way, well, not of course, but along the way, I think for all of us, our glimpses, our tastes, our moments, and these moments can come in all kinds of forms. Just this morning, Melissa and I took Dharma holder Alan's advice and went outside, took a short walk in the neighborhood. And here in Worcester, very cold, low 20s last night, and still a frost at 8 o'clock this morning, frost on the leaves. The sky clear blue, not a breath of wind, and the leaves were falling off the trees. Not just one or two, but a golden shower of leaves falling. And just the slight sound of the clatter hitting the leaves, and several trees having a blanket of freshly fallen leaves in the crisp morning air. These trees, of course, know exactly how to be a tree. Trees don't have to bother with koans, but meeting each moment, each season. And now each tree, each deciduous tree, doing this incredibly complex and incredibly natural work of releasing the leaves. Several years ago, we had a branch fall off a tree in the winter, in the early fall. The leaves on the branch that fell to the ground did not come off of that branch all winter, but the leaves in the tree, of course, did. And it got me wondering about this activity of trees. And it is a thing that trees do to withdraw the nutrients from the leaves and to soften the connection, of the leaf that was so firmly attached to the tree that in the strong winds and rain of the spring and summer, a leaf stays on, a slender stalk connecting it, holding tight to the twig, to the tree. And then when it's time, this connection deteriorates, this connection comes undone. And at a certain moment, each leaf falls with its own gravity. Wendell Berry speaks of this freedom, the water is free in its falling. The leaf is free in its fluttering to the ground. But there is this loosening of the bonds that were so important. If all of the leaves fell off in the wind, a tree would be in trouble. But also if the leaf did not fall when it was time, Then the snow comes and great problem for the tree. In some ways, going on retreat is a way we have of intentionally loosening the attachment, we might say, or wearing down. You and I, each human being, we are so attached to our opinion. And of course, our primary opinion is that I am here and the world is there. This is a wonderful idea, can lead to all kinds of important things, like taking out the recycling on Monday, because that's when the city comes to collect it. This important functioning. And yet this sense of separation of a separate self, I hear, I see, I go for a walk in the morning, is also such a burden. And as we look more closely, which is what we are doing here, looking more closely, what is this? As we look more closely, this separation becomes less and less clear. And our certainty begins to erode. And we speak so glowingly of not knowing most intimate. Yeah, beginner's mind, only don't know. But yet it is also quite a harrowing experience when my story of my life and life and the world, when it begins to break down, this story that has caused us so much pain and causes so much suffering in the human world as we defend our opinion with guns and knives and bombs. We do terrible things to others and to ourselves in the name of this self, this opinion, my religion, my perspective. But when it begins to loosen, we are indeed, we might say, on thin ice. And we long to be set free. We long to be liberated. And yet, as we begin to soften, as we begin to disorient, to slowly dissolve, there is the crying out, no, no, I don't want to die. Zen teachers are famous for their last words, and some quite poetic. The one Zen teacher, his disciples are around him, and he's very, very ill, and he whispers something, and no one quite hears it, and so they lean closer, and they discover that he's asking for a special sweet treat from the bakery in town. And they go quickly and get this sweet treat and bring it to the teacher, who puts it to his mouth, takes the tiniest bit, and says, ah, how delicious, and dies. How delicious. This life certainly is delicious beyond description. And another Zen teacher on his dying deathbed in pain and says, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. This is true too. All of this is true. We might say everything is true. And Zen invites us into this delicious and terrifying world. And this koan that we've been looking into now seems for several weeks, but only a few days here. This koan of the Bodhisattva of compassion. As Melissa mentioned yesterday, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, first appears in the Lotus Sutra. And Lotus Sutra, one of the seminal documents of the Mahayana school, first appeared some 500 years after the Buddha lived. And of course, quotes the Buddha in great detail, saying this and that. But this arising of the Mahayana way, two very important things arising in this sutra. One, it is the idea of the Bodhisattva, the one who puts off their enlightenment, who suffers with the world, who stays in the world. This ideal that the point is not simply to ascend to some other plane, but to use our life, for healing the world. And this idea of the Bodhisattva of compassion, the Lotus Sutra said, when you call out the name Kanzeon Avalokiteshvara, Kanzeon, Kwanzeon Bosa, whatever language we use, when we call the name, the Bodhisattva of compassion immediately hears us and responds. This immediate call and response. And that any kind of call is good enough. Alan's lovely talk last evening about, in a sense, calling out with a flower. When we put a flower on an altar or put a flower on the back of our toilet, doesn't matter where we put it. When we wash the dishes, we are calling out. And this calling out is what we are doing as we practice, as we chant, as we bow, as we sit upright. This is a kind of calling out that comes from some deep part in ourselves, some part that we can't fully know what it is or where it comes from. And in Robert Aitken's wonderful passage that we've read several times, the invocation of Kanzeon, he starts out, we call upon Kanzeon to inspire our sutra and our lives. We call upon ourselves to inspire Kanzeon. We call upon ourselves as Kanzeon. When we call out, we can sometimes think we are calling to something outside of us. In this practice of calling out, as we enter into it, as and this calling out, of course, is nothing other than who you already are. This deep longing, maybe we could say this deep joy, this deep sadness, this deep confusion, but something deep in you. Something deep in you as you touch this, you call out, not because it's a good idea and you think it may get you somewhere, but you call out, I call out with each breath, call out because that's all we can do. And when we call out, we say that the response is immediate, that the calling out and the receiving the response are intimately tied together. There is a term in Zen, kano doko, which means to call out, call and response. Kan means appeal, and no is response. So kano, and doko is, do is the path, and ko means to cross. Kano doko, appeal and response, the way of calling out and receiving the response, this crossing in the moment, this meeting in the moment, you and the universe, there is some possibility of touching this intimacy. Of course, there is nothing other than you being you, you living, me living. And in this life, nothing is left out. This wondrous net of Indra, also, I believe, appearing in the Lotus Sutra, this image that everything, every jewel, every intersection on the net of Indra is a jewel, and every jewel reflects all the other jewels. And there is this singularity and interpenetration. We say everything you encounter is your life. And so how do we appreciate our life? How do we find our way into our life? And of course, you are already there. And yet without, I believe, intense and faithful work, we miss so much. There is work that is required. Dogen talks about this work of Zen in two different ways. On one hand, he talks about practicing as if you were your hair were on fire. The ghost reminds us, do not squander your life. So bring yourself, do your best. Some incredible opportunity here for you to know for yourself, to stop living secondhand, stop taking someone else's word for it, and cut through such an important part of our practice, this spirit of Zen, we say. But Dogen also said we should practice with the effort of a falling leaf. Right, the leaf, when its time has come, one beautiful morning, it finds itself floating through the air, and leaves don't fall straight down. They glide this way and that way with effortless certainty. And so this effort of a falling leaf, this waking up, this finding freedom is an utterly natural thing for us human beings. We might say just as natural as our thinking and complaining, just as naturally come these moments of realization, these moments of connection, when we lose ourselves in the activity of whatever we are doing. Or when we lose ourselves in the stillness and no longer checking, no longer keeping track. Maybe we're too tired, maybe we're too discouraged, maybe we're too happy to keep track any longer. And we find that this self that we have clung to so tightly, can find great joy. Don't have to do it right. There is no right. throughout the body, all over the body. This is beside the point. Something utterly natural taking place here. So this calling out, early on in my practice, I say early on, I probably 15 years in, now seems like early on. I was such a beginner then, now maybe advanced beginner after 40 some years. But a conversation with my teacher, George Bowman, and I was in a very difficult state, quite upset. And of course, I can't remember what the particularity was, but he gave me this practice of kano doko, calling out and receiving. And his instruction was, we have done this with Om Nam chanting, done it as call and response. The first part is to, in your heart, to call out to the Bodhisattva of compassion, to call out to life, to call out to your heart of hearts. Doesn't matter what you're calling out to, we don't really know. Call out to the vast blue sky. But from this place, from this deepest place, deepest place of love, deepest place of pain, call out for help. And as he told me this, I was reassured, and I thought, oh, I know how to do this. It feels like so much of my life is calling out in some way, help me, please help me figure out a way to live my life. Help me find a way. And then the second part of this practice was what surprised me. He said, and then you must stop calling out. And when you stop calling out, the instruction is to receive what arises as the response. So calling out, and I was used to calling out and maybe waiting for a response, hoping that the Bodhisattva of compassion would suddenly manifest and appear before me and take all my troubles away. But very different to practice this receiving, and receiving not in the form that I can expect or know, but to call out and then to receive whatever arises as the response. So maybe it's the sound of the dog barking, maybe it's the pain in your knees, maybe it's the breath, or a word, or an image, or a metaphor. But this act of receiving, equally important to the calling out, right? This act of receiving the world. So often our opinion is so strong, we don't receive what's here because it's not what we think it should be or who we think it should be. And Robert Aitken quite wonderfully says this at the end. The compassionate action of Kanzeon arises from the place of grateful receiving. I venerate the great power for the way which is generated by the profound act of opening myself. This call and response, provisionally we divide it in two, but as we enter in, perhaps we can glimpse this non-separation, this deep longing in you is Kanzeon herself, himself, themself. Here, you have already been touched. And as we honor whatever this is, this deep life within us, this deep life that appears in the form of the tree and the sky, zoom screen. This is Kanzeon herself, who is none other than you and me. So once more, case 89, Yunyan asked Dao Wu, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion expect to do with so many hands and eyes? Dao Wu said, it's like a person in the middle of the night whose hand reaches out for the pillow. Yunyan said, ah, I understand. Dao Wu said, how do you understand it? Yunyan said, everywhere on the body is hands and eyes. Dao Wu said, you've said quite a bit, but you've only said 8/10. Yunyan said, elder brother, how do you understand it? Dao Wu said, all over the body is hands and eyes. Thank you. So please sit comfortably and take a moment to recover and look into the matter together. So for you, what is alive in the calling and responding? Yes, Crystal.
Hello, David. Thank you for the talk. Really nice. And I especially liked the example of the trees and how they don't need koans to be. The thing of the leaves that fall and trust the falling, I would like to take that with me in the meditations, yes.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the way we do Shikantaza, you know, just whatever is happening is our practice. So it's what we're receiving in that moment. No need to make a big effort except to stay upright and present. That's it. And even not being upright, not being present, that's it too. That's what you can receive. So that's when I hear that teaching, I feel very released and relaxed. Don't have to do that. Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Crystal. Anne.
Yeah. As Sasheen has gone along, I begin to realize that my way of thinking about compassion is different than what everyone's been talking about. When you talk about it, it seems more an enveloping thing, like a big cloud. And when I've thought about it, it's always an attempt to listen to and reach out to the other, and particularly the other I violently disagree with. I think I should really reach out to them. I like what Robert Aiken said about receiving. To me, it's taking in what someone else needs me to hear, even if I don't want to hear it. I like your way of doing it better. But that's not where I come from right now.
Well, Anne, I really appreciate you saying that, because all of this, we can get lost in the fogginess and the beauty of some idea of this. But of course, it appears in our actions, in our listening, and how we meet this moment. Receiving someone, allowing someone to be who they are, even if we think they should be someone different, and allowing ourselves to feel what we feel. But there is a way of acting out. And I think this is what we're called to in Zen, not just to sit around on the cushion, but how do we live this out in the grocery store? How do we live this out as we talk to people who have different opinions. And by the way, every human being on the earth has a different opinion from you, and me too. It's just a matter of degree. But I appreciate you and don't think it's different at all. Not to get lost in great great abstraction, but to make it real. Yeah, thanks. At the temple, Corwin or Michael.
Thank you, David, for your talk. I really appreciated how you touched this call and response, because it's always been something that has I've been drawn to, but there was always an idea that there was separate between the call and response. And doing the chanting that we do here with call and response, the Om Nam, there's the activity of doing that is so close that you can really see or really feel the connection, that the call essentially is the response and the response is the call. And this Kanzeyan being me and being at the same time receiving Kanzeyan, it's hard to describe. I know you need to make discrete terms about it, but when you're doing it, there's something else.
Well, you know, as you're speaking, Michael, I'm so, I think you said it very well. I mean, it certainly spoke to me, what you just said. And it's very in keeping with what David was talking about in his talk, that I think human beings really are masters of dividing. And there are practices, these Zen practices, where we begin to understand that everything that's arising is it. That means that, you know, even the things we think aren't it, like disagreeing with somebody or you know, feeling anger or fear, couldn't be it. But if that's the response, then there's just this. Everything comes together in this moment. And again, quite a relief to not have to claw our way through to the division and recognition. Oh, that's the message from the universe. Instead, it doesn't have to be any particular shape. It's just what is. Yeah, is that close to what you're saying? Yeah, so.
Yes.
There we are.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Paul.
Melissa just touched on one thing that I wanted to bring up, that is this aspect of everything we meet is it. And I specifically, what was coming up for me isn't a great appreciation in the koan of these two individuals working with each other. And reminds me, as far as of our Sesshin practice here, this, I come here, I live this life, and I do it with all of you. And it's not limited to this. And the online Sesshins really highlight that for me. So today I've already had two minor disagreements with my significant other. And they've been very mild. And I can feel that little disruption. It's like, for me, it's like, that's not what I thought you would say. And there is this aspect of co-creating this moment really learning about my own expectations and my own desire to control the outcome and the certainty of this moment, and then to realize that there's a minor disagreement, and that's it. It's not what I chose, and that's what I receive, and to receive it, and to receive it. It's really alive for me. I know in Sesshin sometimes we say that opportunity to kind of, we rub up against each other and these edges kind of get knocked off a little bit. And again, I think for me, and this is what you were saying as well, David, in your talk, and then also response to Anne, is that, you know, it, the reality is that it's in everything we do. So when I leave this and I interact with my dogs and Bridget, my wife, that's still the Sashin. That's still this life.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Alan has something to say about that. Is he around?
We can't see him.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm not sure why I'm invisible to you, but I can see.
Okay, we're on the speaker view, so we see just
okay.
A few people. Yeah.
So yeah, and what was coming up for me, I really want to leapfrog back behind your comment, Paul, if I may.
Please. Please.
Maybe this is related to it. That Melissa was reminding us that human beings have a kind of gift for or bent for division. And what mm-hmm. came up for me instantly was that we also have a gift for or a bent for coming together. You know, here we are for making common ground, for finding common ground where there seems to be none. As I'm guessing you've been doing with Bridget and the dogs, as you have had, you know, different right. agendas and you're finding some kind of common ground. And just, you know, flashing on my mind is this moment when I was walking in the street in Waltham along Moody Street, and a man had just fallen on crossing the street and hit the pavement with his head. And someone jumped out to stop traffic, and someone pulled out a phone to call 911. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, what can I do to help? I've told this story before. And this young woman approached and took off this beautiful scarf and came and put it under his head. And, you know, and I had a scarf around my neck and I thought, oh, you know, but this was Kuan Yin. This is that natural arising of compassion for a total stranger and giving up something special that was now going to be blood soap, but mm-hmm. to give someone just a little bit more comfort, you know, mm-hmm. Waiting for the ambulance to come. So mm-hmm. That to me is so compassion to me is not a big misty cloud, but it's an activity mm-hmm. like that. And
right.
And we find it constantly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alan. And you know, I have heard you tell that story before. Every time it feels very fresh.
Yeah.
You know, that some stories, la, 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 you know, oh yeah, that one. But there's a freshness to the understanding of the Bodhisattva's activity, right? The activity of the woman with the scarf in relationship to what we've just been talking about, that for me, compassion naturally arises. But it has to arise through the feeling of division in a way. You know, I'm thinking of a fight with my spouse, a minor disagreement, is that what you called it? You know, it's almost like or Anne saying, you know, that she, the effort to understand another person who you disagree with, in that little moment of being pissed off or angry or, oh no, the reactivity of you're wrong, I'm right, or wanting to know more or whatever. There's some effort involved. And then right underneath that seems to be the common ground. And for me, that common ground is where things arise. You know, so somebody thinks that the other person isn't doing enough around the house, you know, right? But underneath, when we look at these things together, there's the yearning for finding a way through this difficult life. That's what we have in common. And I think that's true for everybody, people we disagree with, people we feel sympathy with or empathy with. It doesn't matter because everything's included. And so the little bit of work is again the work of turning towards, right? Being aware, the simple basis of everything. But what are we being aware of? The division? Or are we being aware of what underlies the division? Yeah.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Paul. Pierce.
Thanks, David. I believe I'm about to air my confusion again.
Please.
Stop.
I was struck by something that you said at the very beginning about how this life makes itself presents itself to us through the various senses, of course, and something that Melissa just said about the underlying, whatever it is that underlies the different experiences that we have. And you know, this has been a very chaotic weekend in my house. My wife was sick on Friday night. There were workmen clumping outside my window yesterday, and my brother-in-law's in the hospital. And here I am on Sesshin, apparently. Mm-hmm. And I think that Sesshin is a real opportunity to investigate this, what is for me a mystery. You know, I'm looking at this experience which changes moment to moment, and I'm saying, isn't it so very strange that it has such multiplicity and such variety? Because I think that and this is part of my wrongheadedness, perhaps, I think that being on Sesshin produces a kind of an effort to create uniformity. It's this persistent illusion that there is a special state that will enable me to be comfortable and to make sense of the multiplicity. So again, I'm just struck by the wonderful opportunity that the online Sesshin presents. You know, that you're in the midst of things and yet you're on Sesshin, and it's an opportunity for me to look into this mystery, which you know, at this moment, I'm particularly feeling the sense of, isn't it strange that life is so, consists of a multiplicity of experiences, and yet they are all arising from the same source?
Thank you. Wow.
Yeah.
Little Dharma talk. It's lovely.
Yeah. And I guess that what I want to highlight, is what you're saying about this this tendency to imagine there's some fixed state, and so then we kind of raid ourselves, well, I'm not very close to that, so I better get rid of whatever this is I have, or get through this to get to somewhere else. And it can be very subtle in some way, so it requires something else. And I love what you're pointing to, that it may require, is it does not require more willpower. Willpower, I think, is a very weak force in the universe. But this kind of curiosity or love, what is this? This mystery, can naturally, then we get curious. We aren't just trying to be good Zen students, right? We've gone beyond that because there's something more interesting than that. So. Yeah, thank you. Barry.
Thank you for the talk. You mentioned a moment when the leaves were falling on your walk today. And I had a moment yesterday. I've been developing a relationship with crows in my neighborhood for 6 months or so. There's six or seven of them. And I only see them about once a week because they have a wide range. And I bring bread with me every day I walk the dog, hoping I'll see the crows. And yesterday, I'm about a mile away from my house with my dog, and I hear a crow caw, and I caw back, which I usually do. And I don't speak fluent crow by any means, but they respond sometimes. Anyway, they came close yesterday. One of them comes on a power line 10 feet above my head, and he starts calling, and the rest of the flock shows up, and I start taking out the bread. They're expecting it. I'm throwing the bread on roadside, and usually I have to be really far away before they trust me to come down and eat the bread, mm-hmm. But Yesterday, I was 20 feet away and they all came down and started eating the bread. And to me, it just feels like an uncanny gift from the universe to have this connection. By the way, you'll notice his artwork with a crow back there. I'm into crows. And anyway, it was just this wonderful experience. I tend to have these during the informal aspects of sessions. And I'm grateful for these little gifts.
Well, and I think this profound act of receiving and what Alan talked about yesterday, I think, in the Dharma dialogue of where is the place where you sing? What brings you alive? For most people, walking around with a bag of bread looking for crows is probably not going to be it, although we all might want to try it now. But for you to do this practice, to open your eyes, you and crows have this little thing going on. And all of us have something going on and can be so important to notice that and appreciate that.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Alan. You first.
I was just going to say, Barry, it probably helps to be dressed in black. And you know, also appreciating the times that you caw and the crows don't come.
Yeah, you can't give up.
Well, and that can be a teaching too. That when we call and we get a very different response than the one that we wanted.
Yeah, I really appreciate that little comment, Alan. It wasn't what I was about to say, but I think it's another view. It goes back to what Pierce was saying, you know, the tendency to think that there's going to be a steady state of illumination that's going to fix everything. And, you know, if I can get more of these beautiful little experiences with crows or whatever it is, everyone's unique, as we've been saying. But I think, I really appreciate that the crows not responding is as important important experience as the crows responding. That's what I'm hearing Alan say, and I really love that. Same way with, we could tell every story from both sides, you know, the day that a bomb fell and killed a bunch of children. Can we also see the value in our response to that? You know, not just the hospital worker running in and picking people up. So it's like at a certain point, we begin to notice that every single thing that's happening is the response of the universe. And I think Zen practice softens us up for perceiving everything that way. You know, I was really struck by David's description of the branch that fell. And those leaves never parted from the branch. That's it too. You know, it's not wrong that those leaves didn't fall, or it's not wrong that the branch fell, that everything that occurs is an example of the Buddha Dharma showing itself. But we tend to screen for only a certain kind of experience.
Yeah, thanks, thank Barry. You. And maybe last one, Bob.
Yeah, this preceding discussion sort of presages what I was going to say is I was very moved at various points in your talk, David. So thank you very much. I love the image of the leaf naturally falling and kind of wafting down to the ground. But as we've been discussing all weekend, not every leaf has that fate. Some leaves get plucked, some trees get cut down. And my question is, if you could talk about, where is Kanzion then? Is Kuan Yin just responsive to crises? Or is there a way that there's some more, I guess, proactive activity?
Kuan Yin is the chainsaw. And the wood chipper. And I think exactly what Melissa was saying. If we're waiting for the Bodhisattva of compassion to appear as she does in the painting, the image behind you, Bob, we may have to wait a long time. And so part of our job is to begin to see more deeply, see into the heart of things. And if we say death is bad, that well, then life is bad. But to see this arising and passing away and hear, and it doesn't mean that we like what's going on or we think it's good. It may be truly horrific and terrible. And yet somehow here this is life appearing and disappearing. So requires some great courage and some willingness to go beyond our opinion of what it should be. The crows should come. Well, they should come when they come. Other times, just this crazy guy running around the neighborhood. Caw, caw. Who's that? Oh, yeah, it's Crazy Barry. Crazy Bob, just crying because they cut down the tree. And he should, and he does. And this is Kanseo. No separation. Yeah. Thank you. With that, let's come back to our posture, have a few breaths, and then we'll be led on.